I should probably explain very briefly two things about my background. I'm an anthropologist, and gang members are my tribe. I have sort of lived among them nationally and internationally for the past 30 years. And I kind of backed into evaluation research, and I don't see myself so much as a researcher as a translator. And what I mean is, there are incredible academicians that do rigorous scientific work, and then there are folk in the community that are practitioners. And in between, there's this kind of gap. And basically, folk in the community want to know what works, but they don't want to sit down and read what's been written about it. And they also want researchers to know what they're doing. Now, the other part of this is when I'm asked to evaluate a program, people don't want to talk about randomized groups and assignment. They generally want me to write an evaluation that's good so they can apply for more funding. And that is one of the single biggest challenges we face in doing community-based evaluation. The folk in the community want to do what they're doing to help people. And they say, go away, don't bother me with this. We just want money to help people. And that is something I think we all have to keep in mind as we do research and evaluation in our communities and look at what works in terms of prevention and intervention. We have to remember the folk out there are trying to help. Now, having said that, we have tools at our disposal that can help them and also add to this incredible fund of knowledge that is out there. So what I'm going to share with you is what I have learned as I have done evaluation. Keep in mind, this is going to be one chapter of this amazing volume that's going to look at everything from women in gangs, family, what occurs in different groups. It's going to take into account a number of policy issues. What I'm going to talk with you today is community, gangs, and prevention. Very much like Buddy, I'm going to give you some of my thinking and then open it up to questions, which I think are the most relevant part of what we're going to do here. All right. Now, one of the biggest thing is vocabulary. There are words that are thrown around without us knowing or agreeing upon what we're doing. And one of the major kind of differences comes between criminal justice folk and public health folk, which is why it's so great. This book is a joint venture between the NIJ and the CDC. We need to know what we're talking about when we mean prevention, and prevention is divided into two categories. It was already shown in the pyramid that Phelan shared with us this morning, that Buddy showed once again. At the bottom is the community, and the community is where what we call primary prevention occurs. Now, primary prevention is directed at decreasing risk factors and increasing protective factors. We'll talk about what those are in a moment, but I think there's a very important issue here. These are also strategies that are aimed at strengthening what already exists in these communities, especially something we talk about, social capital, and I also want to put out there the idea of community resilience. I am so tired, and I know many of us are so tired, of communities being pathologized. It's a gang community. It's a gang-impacted community. It's a hot spot. And I have used these terms. I am the first guilty party. We talk about disenfranchised communities. We talk about poor communities. I've got a newsflash. Those communities have strengths. They have problems. They have challenges. They have strengths. Primary prevention looks not only at the risks, but at those strengths. And I'm going to talk about that in a few moments, but we need to keep that in mind. Otherwise, we run the risk of seeing these as problem communities and a whole bunch of wrong strategies evolve as a result. And by the time evaluators and researchers come in, it's been bent so severely, we're often just picking up the pieces. Now, that's community prevention. Community primary at the community level, risk factors, protective factors. Secondary prevention is also critical. I like to think of this, and I like to characterize it as early intervention. Primary prevention is community-wide. Secondary prevention is very individually based. If you want to think of secondary prevention, you need to think about the at-risk kids. And I am here to tell you, as I live and breathe, after 30 years with my tribe, I can tell you, this is sort of where there needs to be secondary prevention in the worst way. If we catch these kids, and by the way, I use the words kids, I will also say young men and young women, because they are of both genders. Do not kid yourselves. Young women gangbang, and frankly, there's a lot of people in the field who are a lot more scared of female gangbangers than male gangbangers. They are a small percentage of the population. They are growing, and they are just not the baby mamas and the girlfriends of gang members. They are gang members who have been jumped in of their own right. Now, these young men and young women need to be intervened with at this critical point in their lives. That is secondary prevention. You can see that I think of it as early intervention. Now, also important here, it needs to deliver services that are age appropriate. They need to be age appropriate. You'll see later on we talk about culture and gender. And age appropriateness is critical. I'm going to move backwards for one moment and tell you probably one of the most important forms of primary prevention, community-based prevention, is early childhood education and early childhood intervention. But as children grow, we need to design secondary prevention strategies and evaluate them in ways that are age-appropriate for each stage of development. Now, you'll see there, the fourth and a very important point is most of the evidence-based and promising programs offer strategies that are based on this model. Now, this is both a blessing and a curse. There has been some excellent evaluation of secondary prevention programs, but there has not been as extensive evaluation of primary prevention programs. So this is where there has been a great start in terms of promising program and model program evaluation. There needs to be more, and what needs to be added to it is the evaluation of primary prevention programs. Just as I talked about not knowing the difference between primary and secondary prevention, there's a lot of mixed and misunderstanding of prevention and related concepts. I cannot tell you how many rooms I have been in where people talk about intervention, and if you go person by person, not one person knows what the other person is talking about. Some people talk about intervention in Los Angeles, and they talk about Boston and the Boston ceasefire model and the Chicago ceasefire model, and what they're talking about is street intervention. Other people talk about intervention, and they mean more long-term intervention and reentry services. There are all kinds of mixed and misunderstandings about terminology. One of the major things we need in gang membership prevention is a shared set of concepts and terminology, and these must be shared and understood by everybody. Criminal justice, public health, law enforcement, and oh, by the way, did I mention the public at large? Because many, many times people do not understand what these terms mean. In addition, policymakers are often extremely fuzzy about what these terms mean. We need clarity of definition. One of the major things Buddy just did that is so critical is he talked about how to define gang membership. There needs to be agreement about this as well, because we're sitting here in the room, we're all nodding our heads, but there are policymakers and practitioners and educators out there who are unclear as to what the words mean, what the terms are. So we need that. Now, in terms of losing both our mixed and misunderstandings, we need to be clear about risk factors and protective factors. This is kind of my own shorthand. Risk factors motivate the gang behaviors, the likelihood of gang membership, gang wannabe behaviors. These are all the things in communities that add to it. Poverty, disorganization, and by the way, the availability of drugs and firearms. I know I'm preaching to the choir. I know I cannot underscore this strongly enough, but I want to tell you about an exercise that I did when I was teaching a large undergraduate course at UCLA. I taught an undergraduate course. I had 400 students, and I thought I would do a little experiment about the availability of firearms. How many of you have been to Los Angeles? Great. You know Los Angeles is an urban sprawl. You know UCLA is located in Bel Air. It's not what we would call a disenfranchised neighborhood. Most of the students who attend there are not disenfranchised individuals. I had 400 undergraduates, and I said, your class project is to bring to me an illegal firearm. The first person who brings an illegal firearm to me will receive an A in the class. I wanted to see how long it would take a group of 400 suburban undergraduate students at UCLA to acquire illegal firearms. The first gun showed up at my office 8 minutes after class was over. If anybody doubts that that's a risk factor, and by the way, I did have the cooperation of the LAPD. They did come and take all the guns away. I don't want you to get excited. The campus attorney warned me not to do such an experiment again. But I can tell you, what?
How many guns did you get?
I got 425 guns. Some students wanted extra credit. And I found that absolutely, I found that finding not, there was no controlled research, I found that to be a stunning finding in terms of this population. And by the way, they were all illegal. They were not registered. They had, you know, numbers filed off, the whole nine yards. Those are our risk factors. The guns are out there. The drugs are out there. The other risk factor that Buddy touched on that I did not add to my list are the schools, and did I say the schools? Because when we have public schools and private schools, by the way, in states of disorganization and chaos, we also have risk factors. Now, the protective factors are what, in fact, inoculate children and youth against gang memberships. And we will be getting into these in terms of gang membership prevention. If you look there, it is obvious. There is one that I really want to stress, and we're going to go into this, which is positive relationships. And people say, well, of course positive relationships, but the question is, how do we implement those and how do we evaluate those in community-based gang prevention? I want you to store that away in the back of your mind. We're going to be returning to it in a case study in a matter of moments. These are the factors we need to talk about. These are the factors we need to speak to with practitioners, with policymakers, and when we do evaluation of prevention, we need to look at how both are addressed. These are some of the most important factors as we build and do research upon on prevention programs. Now, this is what I call prevention's greatest hits. As part of writing this chapter for this book, I went through copious amounts of reports, research, some of it very well done, some of it, you know, barely quotable, looking at varied programs and what they all had in common when they were promising or model practices. I relied upon OJJDP and also the Center for the Study of the Prevention of Violence in Colorado, and I came up with, and I don't think, you know, once again, nobody argues with motherhood or fatherhood. I don't think anybody is going to disagree with this menu of services. I can tell you that prevention, to the extent that it effectively, and let me underline effectively, integrates these services, and putting them up in a bunch of little boxes isn't enough. There has to be effective collaboration. But this is the menu of what we need. And let me tell you, there are some important provisos there. For example, if you go dead center, take a look. It says parental or family. Dear God, I'm sorry to tell you, there are times we cannot always involve the parents. There are times when the parents are our most important allies. There are also times when the parents are toxic. But he touched on the idea of multi-generational gangs. I can tell you that with some of the gang members that I have tracked over 30 years, I am shockingly now into a fifth generation of gang involvement. And when you talk about a prevention challenge, that is a major prevention challenge. That is the core menu of services. We need everybody at the table, but it is not enough simply to have everybody at the table to prevent gang membership. That is not going to do the trick alone. Even if you have that core menu, even if you have the best intentioned of services, what have we learned from myriad efforts at gang membership prevention? And I will be happy to provide you with a list. OJJDP has a fantastic series of resources on their website. I'm talking about everything from Communities That Care to the Boys and Girls Clubs of America. I looked at the GREAT program. I looked at evaluation that was done throughout the country and even across the border into Canada. Here are some of the lessons learned. You'll have to read the NIJ CDC book to learn everything, but here's some of the highlights. First of all, it's an old social work adage, don't take something away without putting something in its place. If you forget everything I say to you today, you can remember this. Effective programs do everything a gang does, only they do it in a pro-social member. You want to know how to prevent gang membership, give a youth something enticing in its place. It is that simple and it is that difficult. And by the way, I'm going to talk in a little bit about some evaluation research we're undertaking to study precisely this. Now, the second point is something I have encountered in my own evaluation work. I have seen several wonderful school-based programs, and they ended with the ringing of the school bell. They were wonderful as long as school was in session, and as soon as school was over, there was no continuity into the street or into the summer. Probably one of the most heartbreaking encounters I ever had was I was funded to evaluate a program called Youth Lead in East and South Los Angeles. It took place at two major high-risk middle schools, right the age that Buddy outlined in the pyramid, right where we see the kids are kind of at that, I hate to use the phrase, but I'll use it, right where kids are at the tipping point. They could go in, they could stay out. These kids had a fabulous in-school program, and I would walk with the kids after school, and there would be members of the Grape Street Crips at Markham Middle School waiting to pick the kids up after school. The same way mothers and fathers wait in carpool, these gang members, and they were active gang members, I knew who they were, I knew what they were, and they were waiting to pick up these kids. There were also members from Florencia waiting to pick up some of the Latino and Latina, the children there. The same exact thing was happening at Hollenbeck Middle School in East Los Angeles, where I would see individuals who were part of Cuatro Flats and Tiny Boys waiting to pick up the kids after they had been in their wonderful gang prevention program in school. We cannot end with the ringing of the school bell. There has to be the seamless application of services. We have a similar thing occur in Los Angeles. There is a tremendous program right now, Summer Nightlights. They open up parks. They have functions until midnight. They have midnight basketball. They have barbecues. They bring the community together. And then it ends at Labor Day. And Los Angeles stays pretty warm year-round. And yet community members and at-risk youth feel like the circus comes to town and then it leaves after Labor Day. We cannot have this. There has to be program continuity and evaluation continuity. Age, culture, and gender are extremely appropriate. We need to have tailored programs. Now, attachment. Attachment is fuzzy, and yet we know from the menu of services that I just showed to you, the kind of prevention's greatest hits, we need to both provide and evaluate mentors and attachment figures. Not enough has been done. Some has been done, not enough. It is a major point of interest, a major point of concern, and a major point of longitudinal change. Finally, another lesson learned, community or primary prevention. This is not evaluated to the extent it should be. There have been two major evaluations. One is of the Communities That Care program. The other is of CASA START. Both are community-based primary prevention programs that show excellent results when at-risk kids are compared with a control group in terms of their long-term behaviors when kids and communities are subjected to primary prevention. Nevertheless, it is difficult to do the evaluation of a community-based prevention program. Now, I keep saying I want to talk with you about the research that we have been doing. At UCLA, 2 years ago, we undertook the beginning of what we are proposing will be a 5-year longitudinal study of Homeboy Industries. Now, Homeboy Industries is very well known. It's the longtime gang, and it bills itself as an intervention program. It began in East Los Angeles through the efforts of a Jesuit priest, Father Greg Boyle, who recently published a book about his experiences, which I would urge you to read. It's just beautiful. And Father Boyle started with a group of mothers in Boyle Heights 20 years ago during what was termed in Los Angeles the Decade of Death, where there were, in the city of Los Angeles in 1 year, 1,000 gang-related homicides in the city alone. So if you do your math, that's almost 3 a day. Father Greg started very much at the grassroots level, trying to get the violence to stop. And he was aided and assisted by the mothers of the community who were tired of seeing their young people die. Now, over 20 years later, this is now a $12 million organization that serves approximately 12,000 at-risk youth and active gang members a year. And what we were very interested in drilling down into were both the active gang members and the at-risk youth, the highest part of that triangle that Buddy showed us and the level underneath. And what we found was a compelling integration of services, which is sort of represented in this pyramid. Now, the top of the pyramid or the ultimate goal or wherever Homeboy wants to go is represented as education and or employment. And what we found was there was, in fact, thus far we found after 2 years for the success cases, there is the combination of support services, wraparound services, all the things we talk about with prevention's greatest hits, with a combination of attachment to a significant figure. Now, we are following 300 youth, and naturally, they all attach to Father Greg, but that is not their significant figure. They are paired with a mentor who is a former gang member, who they relate to, who propels them through the services, keeps track of them, makes sure they're enrolled in charter school, sees if there's any kind of involvement on the street. What we are finding in a very preliminary way is that there must be, in terms of secondary prevention for these at-risk youth, this combination. Now, it's not enough to just talk about Homeboy. We need to talk about what can we learn from Homeboy and other studies that will help with the challenges to gang prevention. And this is where I'm sure you'll have questions, but I do want to go over this very briefly. First of all, Buddy mentioned his website. I sent him what I have to confess to you was sort of a fan letter because I told him I'm just in love with this strategic planning tool. Now, one of the biggest problems I see with gang prevention is there's a whole lot of planning and very little doing. And so that's why I'm saying do not reinvent the wheel. It's been done. It's been done by smarter people than you and me. It's been done. It's been tested. It's been evaluated. Don't spend 6 months. This is fantastic in terms of being an incredible tool and, notice in capital letters, in times of fiscal, oversight, it is free. Don't reinvent the wheel. Use this. We need to go into our communities and tell people there are resources for them to get started. We also don't need to reinvent the wheel in terms of evaluation. OJJDP and the Center for the Study of the Prevention of Violence in Colorado both do tremendous jobs in terms of evaluation. They have tools. They have protocols. They have questionnaires. They have surveys. We don't need to start from scratch. What we need to do is use the structure, use the skeleton, use what's out there, and build upon it. Now, I want to call your attention to the third point. Here's the third and fourth points. Gang membership prevention. Remember I talked about the greatest hits. So often we have meetings. Meeting is not collaborating. Dating is not having a relationship. We need to actually work together effectively. And by the way, evaluators are a part of this. Evaluators and researchers should never, ever be brought in at the 11th hour, as we too often are. We need to be part of the process from the beginning. It's also important in prevention. I cannot tell you how many programs rise and fall by whether or not they include effective neighborhood partners and not the gadflies, and we all know who they are, who show up at community meetings. Money. Community-based prevention suffers greatly from the lack thereof. This is where, by the way, evaluation and sustainability are inextricably linked. This is where the work of evaluators and researchers must come in at the beginning, not at the end. The way I have made many community-based organizations and faith-based organizations true believers in evaluation is to point out to them that it is in their own self-interest and in the interest of sustainability to show where their program works, to find out what does not work and either improve it or jettison it. In this way, evaluation needs to be seen as literally part and parcel of program sustainability. And this is the other thing with prevention. Prevention programs must be in effect for long periods of time. We yield the results of prevention 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. 15 years is a generation in the world of anthropology. We yield those results both in the short and the long term. And this is part of, remember, the mixed and misunderstandings. We should not look for a drop in the crime rate. We should look at the measures that are really important in terms of prevention. I think here, by the way, we're all believers in terms of training and technical assistance. The ongoing problem with evaluation is chasing success versus chasing change. The biggest challenge we have in community-based prevention and in doing research and evaluation on it is measuring change. I have had a belly full of people telling me that programs work because the crime rate goes down. When I worked in Nickerson Gardens and when I worked in Ramona Gardens on the ground doing ethnographic field work, I would ask gangbangers why they didn't go out. And sometimes they would talk about going to church. And sometimes they would talk about the cops being around. And sometimes they would talk about a mentor from a community-based organization. And sometimes they would talk about how their girlfriend was willing to have sex with them. And those were all the reasons. Yes, you heard me say that. Those were all the reasons they did not go out. Those were all the reasons that prevented them from gangbanging. It is a complex problem. And we need to be able to measure change effectively rather than talking about very clear measures like the crime rate or school attendance, which are important. I want the crime rate to decrease. I want the gang-related crime rate to decrease. I want the school attendance rate to increase. But we need to measure more than increases and decreases. We need to look at change. And remember, we need to look at increased protective factors, decreased risk factors. I'm also putting a little plug in here about social networking. It is an important tool in community-based prevention, including primary prevention, because as we all know, social networking is being utilized by everybody, including street gangs. And I have street gang members who are extremely adept at social networking. I can tell you that I know some people who have been gangbangers for 10 and 12 years who are shot callers, who if they had been born in a different community or had had a different family background would be sitting here or would be CEOs or might be, you know, President of the United States. To reiterate, here's some policy issues and problem areas with community-based prevention. The words. We need a common vocabulary. There is no single solution. Do not pathologize these communities. They are our partners in prevention and evaluation. And I know I'm preaching to the choir. Evaluation must be part of every effort. And here's my caveats. This is back to my don't reinvent the wheel. These communities are strong. Any effective community-based prevention effort must have the grassroots involved. It will fail. It is doomed. The research is there. The ethnographic data is there. This is the reality. And I will say primary prevention, in building with the strengths in these communities, we need to build primary prevention while we maintain the vibrancy of secondary prevention. We need to build these communities and their strengths and their protective factors. We need to draw upon their cultures and their people and the faith-based community, every tool that we have, and we need to evaluate it in terms of community-based prevention. Thank you.